Ashes come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
It's been about a year and a half since Marilyn Vedder grabbed the baton and took over from Howard Vinson as president and chief executive officer of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And it's been a little bit more than a year since Marilyn was the featured guest for a dedicated episode of On the Wing podcast. So with Marilyn sitting across from me smiling, I've got two areas of focus for today's conversation. First, I'm certain our members are wondering, how'd that first year go? So we're going to dive deep with Marilyn on her reflections on year number one as the president and CEO. And second, you've probably read about it in the Pheasants Forever Journal, the Quail Forever Journal, heard about it being chatted about with our regional reps. We have a new strategic plan, or newish. It's about, maybe 9 months old at this point. So we're going to talk about that new strategic plan and make sure that all of our listeners, members or yet to be members, have a little bit of insight into Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's strategic planning and where we're heading for the future. So without further ado, thanks for joining me, Marilyn.
Absolutely. I'm excited to catch up and talk a little bit about, obviously, the first year, but the strategic plan as well.
Yeah. And, you know, to set the tone, probably in the last year, maybe not so much in the last 6 months, but that first year, probably a day didn't go by that somebody didn't email me, call me, like, how's it going?
Oh, really? You
know, oh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, you think about it, the entire history of the organization, there was Jeff Finden, and then there was Howard for 40 years. And like my history in the organization, 22 years, I just knew Howard as my boss. So I think a lot of people, me included, entered into what's been the last year with a little bit of trepidation. You know, like, you know, you have 21 years of one person as
Absolutely.
Your boss. It's like, wonder what this is going to be like. And without blowing smoke, and hopefully our listeners know I don't blow smoke. I'm a, you know, very just real, plain, authentic. It has gone smoother, more exciting than I could have ever imagined. And I mean that both smooth and exciting. Like, you've entered in this role without rocking the boat, but yet pushing everyone forward. I mean, it's thrilling and comforting at the same time. And that's as strong a compliment as I can give you. Like, for 21 years, you know, you come to work every day, you care about the organization, you're passionate. You're like, wonder what this is going to be like. And it's actually better because I feel like hope, excitement for the future. We have a lot in front of us that's very daunting.
Absolutely.
But you've made this just seamless in a really positive way. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you.
I really appreciate that because probably no one had more trepidation than me. Mm. When you think about Howard is a legend, and people had so much emotional connection to him that it scared me a little bit. Mm. I'm like, how will people accept me and my approach? And so knowing that it was intentional that, first of all, the organization is incredibly healthy. It's been very, very successful. So why would you come in and rock the boat? Mm. And throw things up in the air just because you can. So, you know, I was blessed to come into an organization that is healthy. And so it was to really take it all in first before you really start even contemplating what could we do differently and better as we go forward. And everyone's been super welcoming, for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, you came in, you like you said, didn't rock the boat, but also status quo wasn't good enough either. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't good enough for the organization, the mission. Like, you infused excitement, energy, passion, which is what we're going to talk about with the strategic plan.
And lots of questions. I'll never forget when I was sitting in one of your colleagues' office, and it was one of our one-on-ones. He goes, "You ask a lot of questions."
You do. I remember that moment, too. Yeah.
And you take a lot of notes. Oh, shoot. Okay. All right. I'll put the pencil down.
Another thing that sticks out to me, I think this might have been in Arizona. I remember having a conversation with Clyde, your husband, and Clyde's like, "Yeah, a lot of people have contacted Marilyn about a marketing job." You remember this? Like, it was after you got announced. Like, I was like, "Really?" He's like, "Oh yeah, people coming out of the woodwork after your job." I'm like, "Really?"
You're safe.
Well, thank you.
There's no replacement for Bob St. Pierre. Because it was forever and quail forever.
It was pretty funny though. But I mean, it is one of those things that we've all witnessed, right? Mm-hmm. There's a new sheriff in town, right? There's a new leader, and everybody has different philosophical approaches. Sometimes it is a wonderful opportunity to be a change agent and bring in new, fresh ideas. But at the same time, you brought in new ideas, but you didn't necessarily,
like, I didn't clean house.
Yeah, come in with the axe and start swinging.
We didn't need to.
Right.
Yeah. So that was really great that, A, we didn't have to, and we found ways to refresh and revitalize the organization organically, internally.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's dive deep. I've got questions, as you know, prepared. All right, so as you think about the last year and a half, and it, because you took over from Howard essentially right after Pheasant Fest 2023. Mm-hmm. So the Call of the Uplands ends, National Pheasant Fest in Minneapolis concludes, and Howard's like, "I'm hoping for,
adios."
Yeah, I'm hoping we have an early spring, and I'm going to hop on my pontoon. And you know, God bless Howard. He has been very magnanimous about letting you have, you know, running the ship. You know, he's been in. You know, we've had some fun lunches and hangouts, and he's coming to the Clays for Conservation event coming up. But there hasn't been any stepping on toes. It's been pretty, like,
it's been astounding.
Yeah.
To act with the amount of humility that Howard has acted in he truly is one of a kind in living up to the legend that he is, that he has been an absolute gentleman throughout this process and was like, "It's your time."
Yeah.
And I'm here when you have a question. I'm here when you need me. But other than that, it's yours and the team's to run with, and he's been really incredible about it.
And maintain the friendships without it bleeding into professional.
Mm-hmm.
So
again, yeah, we're gonna see him Saturday night.
Yeah, for dinner.
For dinner.
shout out to Howard. Hopefully, I know he's not gonna listen to this podcast. He's not.
Hopefully,
gonna
a friend will tell
him
about
but
it.
Yeah, Howard's just a hero.
Yeah, he is
wonderful guy. So, anyways, think about the last year, and is there a moment, a memory, an accomplishment, one thing that you kind of immediately jumps to mind that you want to, like, you know, that's a high point for me in the first year?
So there's a general theme, and then there is one moment. And we talked about this during my talk at Pheasant Fest on Saturday night about that trepidation that I felt and how astounding the reception has been and how welcoming the Upland community and our members and our chapters, the team, our agency friends, our partners. I underestimated that. I guess maybe it's the natural pessimist in me a little bit, that I thought it would take longer to build those connections. And it has been so authentic. And how, yes, we're always going to get complaints. And you and I share a wall. So we go back and forth a lot of, like, "Oh my God, I just got this email," or "I got this note." And I'm not going to lie that we don't get those very often. But in this role, we have, or at least I have experienced 10 times, if not more, the compliments to the organization than we ever do get complaints. And that that connection, the genuine warmth, the welcoming of our membership has been astounding. The one moment that really sticks out in my mind is I went to the Minnesota State meeting this year, and it was a super fun meeting. Just a raucous group. They were so excited. I don't know. There was something special in the water that day, and it was like 10 degrees. Maybe it's because there was no other place anyone wanted to be because it was so blessed cold. And Scott Rawl, our volunteer of the year for Pheasants Forever this year, it happened to be there. And most people, at least in the pheasant range, have heard of Scott. He is famed as the leader of the Nobles County Pheasants Forever chapter and quite honestly, just a very passionate enthusiast. And he is no pushover. Mm-hmm. You know, Scott is also equally parts willing to challenge us sometimes.
Right. He can be a tough grader.
And he should be. Mm-hmm. Everyone should be. But he said to me at one point of the day, he's like, I know you're really busy, but if you get a minute, I'd really like to chat with you for a little bit over the lunch hour. And of course, my heart is racing a little bit. You know, the pessimist comes up like, oh boy, I'm going to get an earful. And Scott is also equal parts teddy bear.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I just wanted to let you know that you have been very authentic in your approach and transparent as you've taken the lead in this organization. And he said, you have won the hearts and souls of the rank and file.
Hmm.
And that meant a lot to me. Obviously, Scott doesn't speak for the entire organization, but when you have someone that is seen as a leader, and that was a really important statement for me, because the one thing I worried about is that people would think I'm the real deal.
Hmm.
People see me, they automatically think, well, A, she had a job in corporate for 30 years. And I don't know if maybe it's because I'm a 5-foot blonde person. They just don't believe that I, you know, can get on my dogs when I need to when I'm out hunting and dog training, and that I'm passionate about conservation and hunting. And I always worried that people would think that I wasn't the real deal.
Mm.
And so when Scott said that to me, that meant more than anything, because my reply to him was, great, because I am the rank and file. Mm. I am one of you. And you couldn't say anything that would make me feel better than to let me know that people feel like you're one of us.
Yeah, that's awesome. Your comment about the positive comments that come in, the emails, and that resonates true with me too. And it's interesting, you know, you think about, like, people want to root for companies they invest in, right, financially. But people people are financially invested through donations, but it's bigger than that. They want to root for this organization because they care so deeply about the success of the mission. And it is really...
That's true.
Right? It's like they are rooting for, you know, in a different way than their favorite sports team. This is, in many ways, strikes them nearer and dearer, something that they are completely passionate. So you connect the dots to Scott's endorsement of you. It does represent, you know, again, he doesn't speak for everybody, but he is a great representative of the rank and file, the 150,000 members out there that are sending in $35 and saying, go win.
Yeah, you know? It was fun to hear. And it was also what I thought was exciting. He said, and it's provide new enthusiasm for my chapter and other people. And I suppose there's just that energy that's created with change. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're going to take advantage of that as long as we can.
Yeah. Awesome. What aspect of your new job has brought you the most joy?
So I'm no shock to anybody, an extrovert. And so people are the root of it for me.
Mm.
And getting to know our members, our donors, our agency partners, quite honestly, our corporate partners, mm-hmm. our landowners, and our incredible team. I think getting to know the people and finding out what it is about their part in the organization that drives them.
Mm.
So when you're in front of a landowner and their eyes light up and talk about how their land has been transformed by working with one of our biologists and how all of their conservation goals have been delivered and how they're so excited to hear a quail whistle on their land. And they get misty-eyed
mm-hmm.
when you talk to a donor that they've been working so long to be able to fund a BAWA program or support something at their chapter level. And quite honestly, our team, to see the success of them grow and flourish. And, you know, we're just going to next week internally for, I mean, you know, I want to bore our listeners, but next week is National Awards Week at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever for our employees. And that's one of my favorite weeks of the year because I love to hear about how when, so our the people that we give awards to are nominated by their internal colleagues and they don't know they're getting it. Mm. So we, Bob's team does this amazing job of pulling together a script and we get all these photos and we surprise people by these alerts that come into the entire organization's inbox. And I wish I could be a mouse in their offices or in their car or wherever they're uh-huh. listening it because they have no idea that they're getting an award. But I remember after we did it last year, oh my God, people sent me notes like, I am so thankful and so excited and so honored to be recognized by their peers. And so when you see those individual connections, whether it's a team member or a landowner or a partner of our corporate partners who, mm-hmm. and I think about meeting with OnX and how they have talked about, or Federal, when mm-hmm. we were there on Friday, we're like, we love working with you guys mm-hmm. because it makes such a difference with our own constituents. And so I think those, seeing those individual connections of why has been the greatest sense of joy for me.
So do you think we could get away with putting you in as an undercover boss, like for one of these? Oh. I think your height might give you away.
Yeah, probably.
We'd have to figure out how to make you taller and no one would know. Marilyn's here today.
Platform shoes and a wig. No, it would be fun, though. It would be so fun to have somebody. You know, the other thing is, like, do we contact a spouse and say, like, this is coming. You need to be videotaping yeah. when they're watching their video. But it would be fun.
All right. Flip side of it. What's been the most frustrating piece of this job for you?
Probably not going to be a surprise to anybody about the answer on this one. So we have a robust budget. $114 million last year, 89% of it goes straight into mission, which is an absolute boom for conservation. And that's thrilling
mm-hmm.
because that is what we absolutely wake up thinking about doing every day. The biggest frustration for me, and I think for everyone on our team, quite honestly, is when we lose our colleagues because they feel like they have to go somewhere else to make more money for their families. Mm. And I completely understand that. And quite honestly, when we have turnover, almost all turnover here is people self-selecting to go somewhere else and almost always for dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave on good grounds. And, you know, the great thing is that sometimes they boomerang and come back. But it is hard to lose people when you feel like sometimes you have no control over losing them.
Mm.
And I'll never forget, it was the very first Pheasant Fest in this role, and an elderly gentleman came up to me after the CEO roundtable that morning, and he said, you know, my biggest frustration with the organization is that I'm training a new biologist every 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear that. And I know our chapters are frustrated, our landowners are frustrated, and we're doing everything we can to raise the bar internally and working with our agency partners to, like, we need more stability here. And so we're doing lots of things internally, enhancing benefits and asking all kinds of questions that how, and we're never going to answer it for everybody, but I think that's been the hardest part is feeling sometimes like, we lose people that love their job. And they honestly, we've had someone not leave not too long ago that was legitimately teary-eyed saying, I don't want to leave, but I feel like I need to do this because for some people it's also less travel and being home more. So I totally get that. And then I think the other part about that is raising money for infrastructure.
Mm.
You know, I get it. If I'm a donor, I would rather have my name on a plaque at a BAWA site.
Sure.
And I think it's harder to raise dollars for things like websites and event platforms and technology than the tools that our team needs to be more effective as an HR professional or a finance professional and all of those things. So, but that's our charge, is to continue to find ways to raise those dollars. But I think that is my biggest frustration.
Yeah, it's that constant balance between efficiency and effectiveness, right? We've made a name for ourselves in 40 years of, if we raise a dollar, 92, 91 cents of it hits the ground. You know, as we sit here in the industrial park of White Bear Lake with a flat roof that's failing.
Right? And a parking lot that's failed.
Yeah, and we put this pollinator habitat outside, you know, just to have a little piece of the beauty. And the cup plants are growing over you and I, way over our heads. And we are, take such great pride in the dollars that go into the ground. But we are in this industrial park with failing IT systems and, you know, like you say, salaries that are not keeping pace with alternatives out there, even though we have some of the best and brightest that are passionate about this organization. They also have to pay mortgages. So it's a
challenge. Is a balance for sure. I will say that the one thing is that, so I met with the development group last night. They happened to be in town, and we've been, I think as a leadership team in the last 12 months in particular, we've been very transparent about, we know we need to fund this. And we have been very candid about, and we will. And so this event platform will be done within the next 6 months, that our chapters will have a just an awesome tool that they can work with, and our chapter reps need that awesome tool. It's just like, you wouldn't hire somebody in a fire crew and not give them a drip torch. We need to, our employees to have these tools. And we also know that we need a better website. I mean, oh my God, no one tells me this more than Bob's team, for sure. And so we've committed to it. And we've said, all right, that means we're going to have to sacrifice a couple of things. And if we raise enough money, great. But if not, we know what we're going to make some cuts in order to develop some of these things. Instead of always putting them last on the pile, sometimes you have to reprioritize. And I think as a leadership team, we've done that. And so we have also reprioritized. And in fact, we committed as a leadership team to saying, we need to have somebody that's going to lead this effort. Yeah. And so a job posting will go out very soon about someone that is going to come in at a leadership level. We've had an amazing technology team, and they have, when I think about, we have 600 employees and 4 people in our IT team.
600 total employees and four people handling
it's
technology.
It's crazy. I can't imagine the hours and the stress that they feel. And so we need to have someone that helps them build out that team and helps all of us understand strategically, where does technology fit into this?
Right.
Because we can't really fall further behind than we already have. So it's a big challenge for all of us, but we're up to it.
And that's something that definitely is part of your personas, maybe the wrong word, but your philosophical approach that Howard didn't have, right? Like, you wholeheartedly love and believe in putting dollars into the ground for habitat and public access. It's part of who you are and what you love as well. But having a bolstered infrastructure, especially around technology, allows us to do more habitat. It's a long game as opposed to a short game. And you see that in probably a clearer way than any person in the organization ever before.
I suppose some part of that is that I was new.
And
it's hard to look at something for 26 years and see it differently. Yeah. And I had the luxury to come in and go, huh, geez, we're really behind in technology. We really need to do something about that. The payoff is that when we become more efficient, we become more effective. And so it is a long game.
Yeah. We talked about the emails, the compliments. I know another thing that's come over the last year and a half is a whole lot of advice. Some of it I could hear through the wall separating us. Some of it I've heard on the show floor at Pheasant Fest. Some you've shared with me via email. Of all the advice that people, and almost all of it in very good natured, coming from their heart and their passion for the organization. What sticks out to you is maybe the single best piece of advice somebody's given you over the last year and a half?
Ask lots of questions. Challenge the norms. Listen. Listen intently. And then use those learnings to act cautiously but decisively. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but don't be afraid to make a choice too.
You've done a good job with that.
I appreciate that. Yeah. If there is anything, I tend to maybe over-ponder decisions sometimes. So it's pretty rare that I would be so spontaneous that I would... I rarely regret acting too quickly. If there's anything, I probably beat myself up about it. It's like, I should have done that sooner. But that's okay, I think. It, you know, by the time increases buy-in.
All right. Has year behind you, has the job been harder, more difficult? Has it been easier, or has it been exactly what you thought? You know, I feel like I'm the nursery rhyme. Is it too hot, too cold, just ready?
Yeah, the porridge. Is it too hot?
The porridge.
Oh boy, not a big porridge fan. I would say the work load is about what I expected it to be.
Okay.
I am shocked, and I shouldn't say this because now people will think that they should send me emails. I came from a world where I was getting 300 emails a day, so I'm shocked that I don't get 100 emails a day. I'm pleasantly surprised because I can actually have time to focus and work on things. So I love the fact that we are not an email-generated organization. We still pick up the phone and call each other, or, you know, for those that work in the office, walk down the hall and talk to each other. So that's really been cool. I will tell you that I told Matt Kaharsky, our recently retired board of directors chair, about 6 months into it, I said, I'm having more fun than I thought I could. So it's been really thrilling. It's felt more comfortable to me than I thought it could. It feels like it's the exact place that I should be. So that's been super cool and rewarding. The frustrating thing, I think, in anything is the alphabet soup in the world that we live in. And, oh, my God, everybody knows what CRP is. But beyond that, there is just a world of acronyms and programs that I still have to, like, look at my little glossary and the challenge of being an overachiever and not knowing, like, how does that program work and where do we use it? And those things are probably my own frustrations. But then I remind myself that that's why we have 350 wildlife biologists that know those things that I don't need to. But you always want to know what we're talking about. And I'm not very good at faking things. So that's probably been my biggest frustration.
We're going to transition to strategic plan, but before, I know people are wondering, hey, you know, we haven't talked to you since hunting season. What was your favorite, best hunt of last year?
It probably would have been Arizona because we had such good weather there this year, other than the couple of days that it snowed. There were a couple of really bad days of weather. I think the day that we were at Josiah Austin's place.
That was pretty spectacular.
That was pretty special. And probably not just about the hunt, but it was to see the results of an active landowner doing incredible habitat work on his property. Whether I shot a bird or not, it was more about, wow.
In the desert.
Transformed his property, and he was an oasis in a very barren area. And that was probably my best day of the season.
Yeah, because you roll up to that spot, and you and I, right, we're Midwesterners, grew up in North Dakota, live in Wisconsin, grew up in Michigan, live in Minnesota, and you have this view of habitat, you know, lush green, and we travel and hunt sharp tails and pheasants and bobwhites, but you roll up to this spot and somewhat looks desert, just mm-hmm. desert, right? But there was a difference visually to Josiah's property versus all the public land around. And it was, he had taken great care to slow the water down. Mm-hmm. And from that, vegetation emerged out of the desert. And with that vegetation, quail, gambles, and scalies.
It was crazy.
Both exploded, and then there were roadrunners and songbirds and lizards. And it, like you said, it was an oasis. And it changed kind of my perspective. Maybe it's changed over the course of time, but that to me was like neon lights, like, wow, we can do things in the desert mm-hmm. to influence quail habitat.
That was exactly right. Because people say all the time about Western quail, mm-hmm. it's all rain dependent. We can't do a darn thing. And I walked away from that day saying, BS. Mm-hmm. That was so empowering mm-hmm. to know that we could make a difference. And it's different. It's wholly different than how we are actively planting and doing things in the pheasant range. It is different. There it is about how do you make natural rock formations that hold up water, that build vegetation, that preserve those desert rains, those infrequent, very valuable rains for a couple more days. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. And just to see him walk his land mm-hmm. with such a source of a sense of pride, it was really, yeah. It was very cool to walk.
Yeah, that was a really, really wonderful experience. I would echo that was a great
really
hunt
was.
From last year. All right, before we transition to the strategic plan, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Onyx, national sponsor of Pheasants Forever and of Quail Forever, and a supporter of a whole variety of things we do. Build a wildlife area, the Howard Vincent Wildlife Management Area that we opened up last year in Howard's name, on the southern Minnesota, northern Iowa border. Click on the link in the description for this podcast. There's a link there. It'll take you to the Onyx website where you can get a free trial, 1 month free trial of Onyx. And if you use the code PFQF, you'll get 20% off your Onyx membership for the coming year. And Onyx will donate a portion of your purchase to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's habitat mission. All right. I mentioned in the intro that this was a two-parter podcast. We talk about reflections on the first year, and now we're going to move into the strategic plan for the organization. So hopefully there's a lot of listeners out there like, 40 years, I didn't know there was a strategic plan. I'm gonna learn something today. So that is by design. So Marilyn, there's a quote that every time you give a presentation about, and it kind of started with the state meetings in January, and our chapter volunteers were the first to see kind of under the hood on the strategic plan, and then you've been traveling around the country, Purina, Federal, talking about our strategic plan, U.S. Department of Agriculture, now our podcast listeners. But you kick off the strategic plan with a quote from business leader and inspirational speaker Simon Sinek. And Simon's quote goes like this: if a movement is to have an impact, it must belong to those who join it, not just those who lead it. So pretty intuitive what that quote is getting at, but put it into your own words. Why do you include that quote in every single presentation? That's pretty meaningful to you.
It is. In fact, even though I was an internal audience with the development team last night, it was there too. Hmm. Because to me, the word movement, however you think about that word, to me, it shows shared responsibility and commitment. And the reason we've been very intentional about sharing that strategic plan is that it's too easy for people to say, well, pheasants forever and quail forever is going to take care of that. So when you dissect the phrase and it says, you know, in order to movement to be have an impact, to be effective, more people need to join than just the leaders. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy for people to say, and there's part of this is that transition. When you think about this organization, 42 years ago, it was a wholly chapter-driven organization. Mm-hmm. Didn't really have a lot of no paid staff in the beginning. Right. And then it was very minimal paid staff. And as the world has shifted away from volunteerism and to an organization that's grown as large as it has, it's easy for people, I think, to say, well, they got it. Mm. But there's no way this organization can stem the tide. Mm-hmm. When you think about, and I'm not the one that's going to try to inflame people, but when you do think about the statistics, in 125 years, we lost 290 million acres of grassland. Mm. That's 130 Yellowstone National Parks. Mm.
In the last, say that again. How many?
130 Yellowstone National Parks. Wow. Now, that's 125 years. So people might say, well, that's natural. Population has increased. All right.
It's staggering, though, when you think about it.
In the last decade, we've lost 53 million. Mm. That's the size of Nebraska. Hmm. So we can't, and thank God we were here. Mm-hmm. We've saved 26.5 million in that process in those last 40 years, but we're losing it faster than we can build it. Mm. And so the 600 employees in this organization can't be the only ones that own it. And that was the intent of this leadership team to say, we need to share this with, first of all, our employees. Mm-hmm. And so the great thing is that we didn't just sit in a room and say, all right, the 15 of us and that extended leadership team, we got this. We know what we're doing. We said, all right, well, we think we've got it, the frame of it. And just so the listeners know, this is not our first strategic plan. Right. I want people to know that there has always been a very well-written document that's been approved by the board and the driver of the work of this organization. The biggest difference is that we said, this isn't just our team. Mm. Everyone has to find their part in it. And the reason I chose Simon Sinek's words, that I love his premise in general. So the first book of his that I read was called Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Action.
Was it asking a lot of questions?
Yeah, part of it, yes. Like, you know, what is your why?
Right.
And that to me was an inspiring thought about, all right, so then we took it down to the organization. Mm-hmm. We, you know, the four strategic priorities and all of the objectives in it. We had tons and tons of working groups around it. And I know there was strategic plan fatigue by the time it was done. But it's like any muscle. You go to the gym every day. Mm. If you miss for 2 weeks, oh, my God, that first day back, it hurts, right? It's a muscle. Right. And we knew that it was going to be painful. Mm. As we refresh this every year, and as we craft a new one in 2026, it will come easier. It will be better. But that, I think, made our team feel like they're more part of it. And by sharing it with our chapters and our corporate partners and our agencies, and quite honestly, with our members and anybody that picks up the journal and anybody that's going to listen to this, sees their place in the strategic plan.
Yeah. Sort of, you mentioned like volunteerism in America is sort of, it's declining. I mean, it's no secret there, but this is a pushback to that a bit.
I mean,
volunteerism is near and dear to your heart. I think about that first podcast we did together, and you talked about that volunteer mentality. You grew up with it in your family. It was really important to your mom.
It was.
And that's a piece of this too, isn't it? That you
it is.
You know, a movement takes many, and volunteerism is part of that.
It is. It's funny. I don't know why she popped into my head this morning. A dear friend of mine who was a mentor in volunteering. Her name is Bobby Applegate, and she and her husband Jim were at the foundation of NAVDA, and they were probably in those first 25 members. Huh. Back over, it's now probably been 54 years or so. And for years, we didn't have paid staff, and we had they had their own employees that were part of their leasing company that if they had some spare time, they'd have them work on membership or do mailings, and they did that all within their own family, within their business, because it meant so much to them. And she said something really wise to me a long time ago. She said, you know, the first thing and most frequent thing that someone's going to say to you as you become a leader in volunteerism and nonprofits is, somebody oughta.
Mm.
And it drove her crazy.
Mm.
Who's somebody? Who's somebody and what oughta they do? And it when you listen for those words, you'll never unhear it now, because you will hear it all the time in volunteer organizations. Mm-hmm. Somebody ought to do this, somebody ought to do that. And there are only so many somebodies in this organization. So our call in this, sharing this with the rest of the Upland community, not just PF and QF members, is you need to be that somebody, and you need to own a share of the responsibility. Hmm.
There's a t-shirt out there. Somebody oughta.
Yeah.
Right?
Now we have to debate how you spell oughta.
O-U-T-T-A.
I think so, yeah.
We could solve that easy enough. Yeah. You touched on this already, but you know there had been a strategic...
It was pretty new.
It was pretty new. I think you were strategic planning committee chair and...
Not this round.
No, okay, before. The one before.
Yeah.
I think we had updated it maybe within the last 2 years, so it was relatively new. But there was a strategy to the strategic plan for why now, in your mind.
There was. Part of it was I had 6 pillars in our strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do any reading about strategic plans, they'll say, you know, you shouldn't have more than 3 or 4, because when you try to do everything, you do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So one of it was to increase focus. The second was to increase buy-in by including more people in it. And the third, quite honestly, was to bring us together as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really my threefold thought about it. It was, I wanted us to be more focused so that we could be more effective and efficient. And so by getting together and challenging ourselves to say, what should we not be doing?
Mm.
And we used to have a pillar about strengthening the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, what we said was, well, that needs to just, that's the undercurrent. That's there.
That's
and it has to be part of everything.
Yeah.
So we took that as a distraction outside of the strategic plan. And we used to have an educate and engage more for our... We had 2 different pillars on it. You know, one was an internal and one was external. And we were like, you know what, that needs to be brought together. And so I think that was the first thing, was mm-hmm. to fine-tune our priorities, to really evaluate what we should not be doing, and then to really commit to key results,
mm.
which is, we'll get to that part in a little while. But I think that's where some of that discomfort comes, is like, oh boy, we threw some lofty goals out there. And when we were in the room, what we haven't shared with everyone is that we challenged ourselves to think, well, if you're going to think really big and go really far, what does 2030 look
mm-hmm.
like? And we know that those numbers that we threw down for 2030 are not just us. It has to be this entire conservation community. But, you know, we'll get there. We're going to reevaluate that over time. But then I think it was also to increase that buy-in. Because if our members didn't know that we had a strategic plan, neither did a lot of our team.
Right.
And how can we have people, when we tell people we're going to increase accountability, but if they don't know what they're being accountable to, how do I see myself in this plan?
Right.
And so, you know, we're driving that through everybody's individual work plans in the organization to increase that buy-in to the focus that we're creating. And quite honestly, the other was maybe selfish on my part, is to have us come together as a leadership team. Howard had been that leader for most people in this organization their entire careers. And there were actually a lot of the VPs. So the group that got together did the first run on this was the VP and above in the organization. There were 14 of us, I believe, in the room. And a lot of folks were pretty new in that role too. Mm-hmm. And so it was a way for us to really forge a relationship. And for, I believe that was that first time that that team had actually spent 2 days, you know, locked in a room and
yep.
worked on something yep. together. And it made us connect as a team, yeah. I think. And that was one of when we left that room, I felt like we'd really achieved the connection that I was hoping that we would get.
Yeah, to me, it relates back again to Simon Sinek's quote, and it feels like that's pervasive in your philosophy, where in order to have success, the more people that understand, know what you're going for, the more opportunity you have for success, including why we're doing the podcast.
Yeah, right.
Right? Like,
exactly.
Why it's been in the publications. Like, we are genuinely trying to create a movement through awareness. If you were going to paint a picture for what this strategic plan means from a vision perspective on the ground, like putting it into words for people that they can feel connected to it with their heart, paint that picture.
You know, some of it will be coming out in the super issue, I think, mm-hmm. when you think about the on point part that I wrote. And everyone has a vision of what that oasis looks like. Mm. You know, for me, we've talked about that hilltop that Clyde and I love to share in the Fort Pierre grasslands, and a couple of my dog's ashes hang out there forever and eternity because of that. And for others, it's a savanna grasslands in southeast United States, or if it's, quite honestly, chasing chuckers in the mountain range of Nevada, where we have a new chapter focused on the red-legged devils, or the mountain quail, or if it's Montezuma quail. Think about what it is that is your, when you close your eyes, and your favorite vista, and having more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the strategic plan is words on a paper, and it's how, it is what we do, but it, what will bring us together is how we do it,
mm-hmm.
and why we do it.
Yeah.
And it's, for me, it's the why. And
it's very not personal.
Yeah, it is. It should be.
Mm-hmm.
If it means something to you, it should be personal.
Yeah. The other piece that's been really important to you is culture. And we think about that in this plan, wrapping around values. Mm-hmm. So values, we have values that make up the organization, what we will model in the process of achieving that vision you just articulated. Tell us about some of the values that you wanted to integrate in this plan.
So I think as an organization, we've had a longstanding history of some of those values, like integrity, trust. And we are that trusted advisor and trusted colleague in that space. But when we sat down and we worked on the strategic plan, we thought there were two gaps that we really needed to focus on. One was being more science-based in our approach. I think it hasn't been that we haven't had zero science. Obviously, we use science, but it's to be more intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And so that people understand that these aren't random acts of conservation.
Right.
But when we get into the real meat of the strategic plan here in a couple of minutes, you know, one of the things that I'm most excited about is that we are challenging ourselves to create models that will be more predictive.
Mm.
Of what landscapes with these kinds of activities, not just create more habitat, but create more birds,
mm-hmm.
which is really what people want to hear about.
Yeah.
And so challenging ourselves to find the right solutions and then to measure them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you measure them, it's to be validated externally, but it also increases, which is our second value that we added, is accountability. And we're holding ourselves accountable, and not that we haven't, but we have typically, historically as an organization, told people what we've done. And to me, this is a transformational shift in the culture and how we communicate with everyone else as we just told you what we're going to do. That's a big shift. And it doesn't sound like much, but it is. And when I think about how some of the our teams have are like, wow, those are some big numbers. Do you think we can make it? I do. Do I think it's a stretch? Yep. As I said to some of the folks last night, I hope it scares you just a little bit. Because that stretching is what will make us better. And it will make us find bigger solutions to our big problems. And it can't be incremental. It needs to be pervasive.
Right.
And so I think having accountability as a factor that we're telling our chapters and our members and our we've always told it to our partners and our agencies, but we haven't necessarily professed it from the hilltop of what it is we intend to do. And that's a big shift.
Right. You know, here's your sports analogy for this episode. I think about it with pick baseball, the Olympics, whatever, you know, it's like you don't just go out onto the field or, you know, the court or the ice rink and just let the chips fall where they may.
Right.
You're out there to win a gold medal or a World Series, so you have goals. You do stretch. And the same thing with a business. You know, it's not like, well, we'll just tell you what we do. Like, no. Like, tell you where you're going. Tell us where you're going.
We're putting it on the line.
Yeah.
And that's a transformation in our thought, in our approach. And the other part about culture is, so strategic plan is what you do. Culture is how you do it. And so when we think about how we're going to be accountable, how we are going to do that work with intention, it is, this might sound mushy to people, but I to me it feels like those cultural principles of how we are going to work is the soul of the organization. And that's the forever part. You know, strategic plans are made to be changed and updated. Because as work transforms,
right.
We
adapt
do too.
And evolve.
But a culture should be in just completely built in the foundation of the organization. And it is not just about what we do, but how we do it with our people so that they feel like they're cared for and our entire team feels like we're investing in them. We have to remind everyone that, well, our work is super important. The people that are doing it are super important too. And if there's anything that I suppose nonprofits in general are guilty of is sometimes forgetting that part. Like the work should be enough for them. And well, of course it's important to them. They wouldn't work at a nonprofit if it wasn't. Because we know the sacrifices that are made to work at nonprofits. But that means you still have to have an environment where people feel like they're valued and heard and have decision-making rights and empowered to be able to do their job effectively and have leadership that supports them. And so I feel it's really important that we have intentional conversations, and we've been doing that internally of, do we have the culture that we say we have? And if we don't, where are we falling down? Where can we be better? And how do we hold our leaders, all of us, accountable to make sure that our team feels, and our chapters and our volunteers and our leaders inside this organization feel like we give a damn.
So you mentioned the word nonprofit, and it's not a word I've spent much time thinking about, honestly. 2 days ago, I sat in a chair to get my hair cut. It cut it really short, by the way.
Maybe that's why you have a hat on.
But it was probably, yeah, it was why I have a hat on, to hide my bald spot that is increasing.
Well, at least it's not January.
But my answer to her question, which I'll tell you in a minute, must have been so captivating because she just went zoom, zoom, zoom.
She was trying to save you money so you didn't have to come back as soon.
So she asked, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I work for a nonprofit conservation organization down the street. She's like, nonprofit, what does that mean? And it stopped me. It's like, well, that's not a question I've been asked recently. And my answer to her was, well, most corporations, you know, they're trying to generate profit, revenue for shareholders, for owners. Like, that's the end goal. to create revenue. In a nonprofit, you still are trying to create revenue just the same as a for-profit, but the dollars are not going to the shareholders or an owner. It's being pumped into completing the mission that the organization exists to complete. So in many ways, in my view, here's another baseball analogy, I view nonprofits very similar to sports teams in that they are trying to win, right? Win the World Series. But they're also trying to create revenue so they can add players, do more, right? So in many ways, it can be more, viewed as more complicated. Did I get that right? Or
no, that's totally right. There's someone on our development team that challenges me every time we use nonprofit. He said, I prefer to consider us as a for-purpose organization.
Mm-hmm. That's a great term. For-purpose. We exist to do something.
We are a purpose-driven organization.
Yeah.
IRS considers us a nonprofit by their categories, but I think that is true, and that we're driven to achieve mission, and it's purpose-driven and passion-driven.
Yeah, it feels like nonprofit, that term, that is dated. Like yeah. It should, let's throw that out of
leave
the vernacular.
It out of, yeah, exactly. Because The more profit, more ROI we return, the more purpose we can deliver.
More habitat on the ground, mm-hmm. Birds in the air, cleaner water.
Soil, biodiversity, absolutely.
Public access.
We answer all those things.
Mm-hmm. For purpose.
For purpose.
I like that. For folks that are listening, they might be like, boy, a lot of change going on there, right? Which is good, but it also could create trepidation. So I want to read to you our mission statement, which is also a grounding piece of the strategic plan. Our mission statement heading into the strategic plan was, we exist to conserve pheasants, quail, and other wildlife through habitat improvements, public access, education, and conservation advocacy. What did we change in the strategic plan related to the mission statement, Marilyn?
Not a darn thing.
And that's a statement in of itself, isn't it?
I bet it is, many exclamation points. In fact, at the CEO roundtable last year, somebody asked me that, like, what are you guys going to change mm-hmm. about the mission? And I said, that's our North Star. Missions should not change, or they should not change frequently. Now, we have tweaked it a little bit by adding access a few years ago because it was one of those, how could we have not had access in their beginning?
Because we're doing a whole hell of a lot of access.
But we didn't change what we do. Mm-hmm. And so, the mission is what drives you every day. Your vision is what you aspire to be. Mm-hmm. Your values are the things that you hold dear as you approach your work, and the culture is how you get it done. And so the mission is what we're all connected to.
Yeah. All right. That's kind of the foundation, now the meat of the strategic plan. So it gets a little bit heavy here. So I'm going to kind of detail. We've got four strategic priorities. I'm going to read them to give our listeners kind of an understanding of the landscape. And then I'll ask kind of a question or a pair of questions about each one. So four strategic priorities. Number one, increase and improve wildlife habitat on public and private lands. Number two, advance conservation policies and program funding. So in my mind, I always come back to government affairs, advocacy. Mm-hmm. Like that's the federal, state, local government connection that folks are in tune with. We just rephrased it a little bit. Number three, here's that access word. Expand public access to upland wildlife habitat. And number four, expand, educate, and engage the upland conservation community. So for keywords here, number one, habitat. Number two, policies. Number three, access. And number four, community. So There's a lot to bite off there. So I'm this is a giant document.
It is.
So I'm going to ask two-piece question about each of these four for you, Marilyn. First, for the first part of the question, each of these four strategic priorities begins with a page titled Intent. So I'd like you to explain, and we'll go through these, habitat, policies, access, and community, the intent for each of these. And then the second part of the question as we tackle them is, without going into the gritty details of everything, what's the one thing in each of these strategic priorities that jumps out to you as capturing your imagination, your passion, your energy? So let's start number one, increase and improve wildlife habitat on public and private lands. What's that getting at?
You know, if you wanted to say you had a strategic plan with just one strategic priority, we could have said, period, done. This is what we do.
Mm-hmm. Habitat.
This is our mission.
The habitat organization.
Exactly. And you could say, quite honestly, that all of the other things around advocacy, access, and engagement ladder up to this. But we know that there's so much in each one of those that oversimplified what we do. But this is all roads do lead to increasing habitat on public and private lands. You mentioned the word intent, and words are important, I think, in the strategic plans. And so you earlier mentioned the word movement in the quote from Simon Sinek. And there's another word in that that is really important, is impact. So when you have an intention, there's a reason. Mm-hmm. You have the intention that you're going to have a specific impact. And to me, that was why we started everything with a page of saying, our intent by making this a strategic priority is that we are going to do the following things, which are the key results, the numbers that we've committed to, that everybody can refer back to their journal that we've committed to. So to me, this is absolutely the core of what we do. These are where our giant numbers come from, of hundreds of thousands of acres of public and private lands, of whether or not we're working public lands to open them up or to enrich them and increase the quality of that habitat, or if it's a private landowner. And when I think about we talked about this a little bit earlier, what I'm most excited about in this one is building those landscape models that will be more predictive, using our science-based approaches to where we should put our effort. Now, that's going to make people a little uncomfortable sometimes, because sometimes people are going to say, well, I can buy this 20 acres right here, our chapter can, and we want you to do something there. But we might be able to get 1,000 acres somewhere else. That is much more likely to add to a mosaic that really increases, whether it's nesting cover, winter thermal cover for that entire landscape. Mm-hmm. And so it's building the models, which are going to take us some time. This is truly, this priority is a long game.
Yeah. Yeah, like you said, it's, it's no longer random acts of conservation. There's science, there's strategy, there's evaluation and prioritization. And that's where we got to be when you talk about how many Yellowstones we've lost in the last 100 years.
Exactly.
Number two, advance conservation policies and program funding. Tell us the intent in the thing that jumps out to you there.
We carry a lot of water in this one for the entire, not just upland conservation community, but I think quite honestly for conservation in general. Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever has a storied and very well-regarded history in advocacy. And that's fantastic. It's been great, not only for our work, but I think for conservation in general. So our job has been predominantly focused in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. and working on the Farm Bill. And we have not strayed too much from that. Obviously, working on programs with USDA and NRCS, but we haven't dove into a lot of other legislation. But when you think about the Grasslands Act, it's more interior branch focused. And now we're starting to think about, well, we haven't really played in with the Appropriations Committee much in the past. And, well, geez, they hold the purse strings. So when you're trying to advocate for policies that impact conservation, you have to think about it as an entire ecosystem.
Right.
And so this is, quite honestly, how you have the greatest source of funding for strategic priority one. You know, we can raise dollars all we want, but if we don't have government programs that support conservation and the North American model of conservation and, quite honestly, hunting heritage, there isn't enough, in my mind, enough private dollars to do that. And so we have to make sure that our members and their our members' desires are represented here. What I'm most excited about, and you and I talk about this a lot, is that we are now finally not going to dabble in state government affairs. We have a dedicated person to do that. That one person can't do 50 states. We know that. This is a first step into building a state government affairs team. This is near and dear to my heart. I spent 20 years lobbying in state houses, and I think it is where we can have a tremendous amount of impact. It is also our greatest way to engage our chapters and our members, because all politics are local.
Yeah, it is. And you think about some of the major success stories, and we've talked about it ad nauseum, Minnesota's legacy amendment in the landscape level impact that's happening. And, you know, we had win in South Dakota with a brand new license plate for habitat. And there's wins big and small that are to be had at the state level. We just haven't always been playing there.
Yeah.
And now, like you say, we got a dedicated employee and hopefully more to come.
Yeah, absolutely.
Number three, expand public access to upland wildlife habitat. The intent and what energizes you?
I think for a lot of people, this is their why. Like, why are you involved in conservation organizations? Why are you committed to it? Because they are public land hunters. And you and I spend the majority of our hunting season on public lands, and I would have it no other way. First of all, none of us are going to own enough land for as many steps as you and I invest in this process. I'm never going to own enough land to hopefully get enough steps in on. But this is a call to twofold. It's public and private. So the public lands that we already own as citizens of this country, to make sure that we can open up as many of them as we can, whether you're a hunter or not. If you want to be out there to just see and witness Mother Nature, then fantastic. But it's also for those that are involved in the hunting season. I think it's really critical that we do everything we can to access and open as many of those lands as possible. And then on the private land side, it, you know, it was funny when we were with some of our members from North Dakota last week, we had a really long, intense conversation about landowners and their viewpoints on having people come on their lands. And, you know, some people are like, I have enough people on my land with my own family. I don't want to have anybody else. And there's others that say, no, I love having people join me on my lands. I just want them to ask permission. I want them to have some kind of structure around it. And we talked a lot about what does access look like. And this pretty closely weaves to that last priority about state legislative initiatives and, and how does access work. The one thing that I think I'm most excited about is our team has really done a fantastic job of innovating with the South Dakota Game Fish and Parks to create the South Dakota PATH program. And along with Onyx.
And South Dakota Tourism, too.
And South Dakota Tourism, excuse me, I forgot about them. And that was really as a result of the success of the Aberdeen Pheasant Coalition. So when you talk about communities that are engaged in conservation, that was a phenomenal example of how that community said, we're going to own this. We're going to figure out how we incentivize and raise money for landowners to be willing to open their land to hunters, which completely benefits Aberdeen in so many ways, not just economically, but quite honestly to the fabric of the community. And so when we took South Dakota PATH public, people were ecstatic about it. And we quite honestly got questions from lots of states like, well, how can we do that? Mm-hmm. And so we know we don't have that all solved, and but we're excited to say that we're going to try to figure out state by state how we do that. It'd be impossible to create a... We will have a nationwide initiative to raise dollars, but now we have to figure out how we deploy that in states. And this, I think is what gets people super stoked about how they can get engaged, whether they're a landowner or someone that wants to use the lands.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right there with you on this one, too, because we've done a podcast about PATH, which stands for Public Access to Habitat. You can go on the website, pheasantsforever.org/PATH, and you'll learn all about what's happening in South Dakota. More than 10,000 acres in less than a year enrolled, improved for habitat, and opened it up for public access. It was open last hunting season.
And a waiting list for people that want to get involved as we raise more dollars for it.
So now it's, okay, we've got some magic here. How do we box it up and move it around the country? And I'm right there with you. This one really energizes me as well.
Yeah, I think it's exciting.
All right, number four, expand, educate, and engage the upland conservation community. This is a harder one to wrap your head around.
There's a lot of words there.
A lot of E, a lot of action. Intent, and what excites you the most?
I think the intent is to broaden and engage this community. Broaden and help them feel inspired. So obviously we need to increase the numbers of people that are engaged in the upland community. If we're going to preserve not just the acres, but the use of those acres, we need to have more people understand, why would you tromp around in cattails in December? What is the magic there that you feel? And if you've never experienced it, you don't know. And so it is educating them, asking them to come along, you know, and helping them feel empowered in order to do that. So it's definitely broaden that community and help them understand what find their own why, and then find their connection to it. And then hopefully you're also bringing not just members to, even if they don't join Pheasants Forever, but if they discover that they're avid waterfowlers and they join DU, or they decide that turkeys are their bird of choice, and they joined the National Wild Turkey Federation. It's a win.
Right. Or they love pollinators and figure out, oh, this is brood habitat. It's the same thing.
Forever depends on this. That part of our name is really dependent upon this. Yes, we can have land, and we can create policies that can often be changed, and access. But if we don't have people that use it and value it, it will go away. You know, we had a conversation the other day about somebody looked at the grasslands map of North America. And if you look at it, it's frightening. There's only 4 million acres of native grassland left in the United States. And someone made a comment to me about Saskatchewan. Because when you look at Saskatchewan, it's really yellow and red, and their grasslands are vastly depleted. And they asked me a really important question, and I can't speak to it because I don't deal with folks that much in Saskatchewan, but they said, do you think it's because people don't hunt there and they don't value it? And so when you think about if people aren't using something, it's not seen as a resource. And we know there's a huge disconnect between people's attitudes and perceptions of our natural resources. And one of those disconnects is that they take for granted it will always be there. And it won't be.
It connects back to, like we talk about it, the connection between hunting, conservation, and our public acres. I mean, it's... If you can't hunt a species or you can't hunt a place, you lose that mental and emotional tug. And that's...
And you forget about it, quite honestly.
You find something else.
You do. And that's sad for us if we lose that connection. The one thing that we're excited about adding is some grassroots activity, particularly on the advocacy side. And that to me is part of this, wholly part of this educate and engage part of our Upland community. And Suzanne, who's going to lead our state government affairs work, is going to lead those grassroots efforts. And part of that connection is being empowered to feel like your voice matters and teaching people how and when to use that voice. We don't want to overuse that voice, but we want people to feel like they have a say in it. And so I'm excited about us being able to build that grassroots connection as we go forward.
Yeah, we talked about this as well with that chapter during the tour, where we've been very judicious over time about when we try to engage our volunteers to use their voice in D.C. or in their state capital of Des Moines or, you know, Dover. Mm-hmm. And that's likely not going to change. We're going to be very judicious Absolutely. About it. But when we ask, and this is an alert right now, like if we ask about the Grasslands Act or the Farm Bill or some bad pieces of legislation that we're playing defense against, when we issue an action alert, all the listeners out there, it's like, we mean it. Yeah. We really need your help.
We will not cry wolf. When you hear from us, and it's the real thing.
There you go. We issue an action alert. So stay engaged. Social media, you know, it has its ups and downs,
yes,
but
does.
One of its greatest benefits is reaction time. You know, I think about the start of my career here. You know, Facebook didn't exist. We barely had email, right? And
right.
Now to motivate people to contact their elected officials can happen with, you know, matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. That's powerful.
It is powerful. And I think our legislators appreciate it too. I'm sure it's sometimes a nuisance, particularly when you have millions of people mm-hmm. bombarding your office. But it is also the easiest way for them to stay connected to us, because
right.
how else do you connect when you think about it? You're from North Dakota and you have one member of Congress, and while he might have less people to represent than a congressperson in New York, he also has a giant state.
Right.
And this is a great way for them to hear from someone in Williston all the way down to Wahpeton.
Yeah. You did the alliteration to Williston to Wahpeton. I did Denver or Des Moines to Dover. So follow us on whatever your favorite social channels are, Instagram, Facebook, X/Twitter, Threads, you name it. Very unique to you, Marilyn, is you have not just one boss, you have a whole cohort of bosses, our National Board of Directors, where you're judged on, you know, the strategic plan we've laid out, our habitat goals, our financial accomplishments, the for-profit financial
yes.
component. What else is the board looking for from a vision perspective, and, you know, that we haven't touched on as part of the strategic plan, that in the spirit of Simon Sinek, that is worthwhile for our members to know about?
I'm glad you asked it, because there's something in particular that doesn't fit neatly in the strategic plan, and it's our emphasis on our connection in our habitat work and sustainability.
Hmm.
And that, so our board challenged us with it. It's like, how do we sit in this space? And so, no secret, we've had Brent Rudolph has been leading our sustainability efforts for the last couple of years, and he's done a masterful job at it. But our board wanted to understand more about how we're doing it and what can we build as we go forward.
So just to pause for a moment, sustainability, it's somewhat ambiguous. So explain what you mean, what the board is looking for when you use the term sustainability for the audience.
So when you think about the things that are involved in sustainability, people automatically assume that they have a knowledge of what that is. And when I think about sustainability and conservation in our spaces, it's a commitment to biodiversity, so that you don't have a monoculture when you walk out in a prairie. And sometimes that means it's a pollinator planting, or if nothing else, it needs to be a much more diverse landscape than we've experienced. It is how we can use those acres to protect water and create better riparian zones to improve soil health so that we are protecting the soils, and whether or not it's through CRP or other programs. And then really, how does that impact overall in climate resilience? So when we think about how we are trying to measure our work, some of the things that we're building our tools around is what levels of carbon do grasslands sequester as compared to trees and other assets that are sequestering carbon? How do we find ways that our landowners can be rewarded for their efforts, not only in conservation, but perhaps also in carbon sequestration? And what are the ways, the work that we're already doing, not changing our work, but what are we already doing?
Right. Again, the mission statement is not changed.
No.
It's all this habitat work we're doing. How do we position it under the umbrella of sustainability?
And the whole process, in the end, we're still doing everything to create birds.
Yeah.
And so it's finding the sweet spot in the middle of that, of how does 3M or Cargill or ADM, any corporate organization say, well, we want to make sure that we're participating in sustainability efforts. Mm-hmm. What are you doing, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, already in this space that perhaps we could help support and not change a darn thing about what we do? And that was, so our board got together, they passed a resolution of, we want to continue to find ways that we can do that. And the number one part of that resolution was, and not change the work that we do. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important for our membership to know that if we look to raise dollars for sustainability, it is to not change the work. It is to support the work that we do already. So I think that's one thing that they've talked about a lot. The other thing is, you know, we give them a scorecard every time we meet, and we meet six times a year, to give them an overall view of how we are attaining the key results that we committed to in the strategic plan, along with a couple of other things that don't fit so neatly into that. And two others are workforce health. We have not typically measured that in the past. Mm-hmm. And that is an internal metric that we've created with, it is a combination of results of employee surveys of engagement and how they feel about the culture that we've created here and the things that we're giving them and tools for development and opportunities for growth. Retention, mm-hmm. which is our biggest challenge, and so we committed to continue to try to reduce that, and then also the other things that we can provide for them, like benefits and those kinds of things. So really holding our leadership team to improving our workforce health criteria. And then the other thing, we talked about it briefly, was technology, and we added that to our scorecard to really show our accountability to, we know that technology is an area that we have not delivered to the fullest degree that we need to, not only just for our team, but for our chapters. Mm-hmm. And we put ourselves on the line and said, we will commit to the following things in the next 3 years because we know we have to. And sometimes by doing that, it just makes us go out and raise the money for it.
Yeah. Real critically, anybody that works for any company, right, sees workforce health, unemployment rate, turnover, people jumping jobs. I mean, it's a world we live in. We're also chasing technology, not unlike a lot of other businesses out there. The thing that I want to circle back to just for one more moment is sustainability, because we know that there's a lot of momentum there, mm-hmm. and opportunity there. And, you know, if there are listeners out there, whether it's Cargill or Coca-Cola, right, McDonald's or Archer Daniel Midland, we have ways to engage in our habitat mission, our grasslands habitat mission, that fit what your goals are. Because darn near every company in the country, Walmart included, is trying to accomplish sustainability goals.
Absolutely.
And we have the tools to help make that happen. So if you're listening, and you were mentioning Brent Rudolph, brudolph@pheasantsforever.org, please connect with me, and I'll get you connected to Brent. We are actively trying to build sustainability efforts, which is the exact same of our habitat mission.
It's so funny because when I think about it, it has its own name, but yet it doesn't change a darn thing. So when I think about...
It's conservation.
When we work with landowners, particularly those that are... So one of the new efforts that you're really hearing, and it's not new because it's really old-style grazing, but AMP grazing. When I think about lots of organizations that are saying that they're really, particularly grocery chains, of how they're trying to increase grass-fed beef into their product lines, finding ways that we can, you know, we don't have it today, but we can build it. How do you connect them to landowners that are doing these practices so that they can increase that supply? Because we know that more and more people want to have products that are raised in a way that they would feel better about how they consume them. And that doesn't mean that corn finished beef are any less valuable, because we know how tasty they can be too. But there are ways that we can meet all of these missions together that doesn't feel disingenuous. Quite honestly, when you look at Native Prairie, and I've only been on one piece of property that's really 100% Native Prairie that's been undisturbed, it looks incredibly different. And the only thing I can tell you is that it's not 10 feet tall, and it is just this vast landscape of so many different plants that I've never experienced before. And that is that biodiversity. And if there is anything that I think we could do really well, it's when you think about pollinator plantings, what makes them special? The diversity in those plantings.
Right. The pinks and the purples and the yellows and reds. And the quail, sharpies, and roosters that come with it.
Absolutely.
All right. Now that we've recapped the entirety of the plan and some of the key components that the board of directors are looking for as well, let's put a bow on this and talk about... we use the term building forever as sort of the umbrella theme of the strategic plan. What's building forever mean to you, Marilyn?
Well, as we talked about, we have a lot of work to do to achieve our conservation goals, and it's going to take all of us to build that future so that future generations, the ones that we talked about, an expanded, broader base, can enjoy the same uplands that we love and that they're filled with pheasants, quail, and songbirds, bees, butterflies, and all wildlife. When you put a bow on it and you think about it, conservation is a movement to restore, maintain, and protect nature and upland habitat. Conservation is an active stewardship. It doesn't have an end date. And that means that conservation is truly forever.
And that's what we're building towards. And as we're compiling, so our fiscal year really just ended, and as we're compiling the statistics, we know that, and this brings a great big smile to your face that our listeners, I wish our listeners could see, because this is a testament to your leadership. We're going to set records for the organization and habitat accomplishments, public access created, as well as permanent protection acres, which is also public access. For the first time in our organization's history, we've crossed the 150,000 membership mark. Really, every metric possible.
And more engaged audience than we've ever seen.
Yeah, larger number of social media followers. More podcast listeners. Thank you all. That's a pretty gratifying kind of closing statement, is while we haven't solved the upland crisis that's out there, we've got winds of progress moving in the right direction.
Absolutely. A bow is a perfect description for it. It's a gift that we accomplished this year, and I can't wait till people get done, wrap it, and hear the news.
And with the quote that you always mention from Simon Sinek, this isn't just our effort, it's all of our effort, everybody that loves the Uplands. So hopefully you can find your place in it. In the show notes for this podcast, please click on the link. It'll take you to an article called Aiming High, which details the strategic plan and some of the overarching goals. And you can learn a little bit more. If this 90 minutes didn't provide everything you're looking for, hopefully whet everyone's appetite to read a little bit more. Marilyn, thank you very much for spending all this time and being as transparent about our goals as you have been in the first year. And I look forward to year number two, which honestly, we're already in.
Absolutely. You're welcome. And I appreciate you taking the time to really dive into this for our listeners.
All right, folks. That is Marilyn Vetter, the President and Chief Executive Officer for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Hopefully you are as inspired listening to her as I am every single day that I come in the office and we share, like we said in the podcast, we share a wall and we have a lot of fun together. Thank you for listening, and remember to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.